Before we begin, just giving you an update on our new subscription. It's called David McWilliams Plus on Apple. You just double click, you get no ads, and you get me and John, pure and simple.
And Mac, you get early access to episodes. Did you know that?
Sure, my day is made.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
To understand the economy, you have to understand human nature.
This podcast is powered by Acast.
How are you doing there? It is podcast time, middle of June. I have been watching various Irish weather sites. This is a dilemma, John. When you put on a festival in Ireland, you become hostage to many eventualities. But the main one is the Irish weather.
Yes.
Right? There's a very, very fine weather station. I believe it's Norwegian. It's a website called YORNO, which is highly accurate. I can give you those.
Oh, really?
There is the old Met Aaron.
Met Aaron are good.
There's an extraordinary Met Aaron Atlantic Charts website.
Yeah.
Which is now what I'm on.
Love a good chart.
And the chart sort of shows the high and the low pressure out in the Atlantic.
Can you read weather charts?
Not at all. I can see them. I
used to be able to do all the... I did a load of meteorology in college. Yeah,
did you?
It's fascinating stuff.
It is great.
It's really complicated.
Well, when I'm watching it, I'm thinking of Yeats, turning and turning in the widening gyre. This is the opening line of the Second Coming.
Right.
And the gyre is a North Atlantic weather front. And I am now watching these things.
Right.
Not least because on this weekend, having good weather or having not wet weather. Okay?
Yes. Yeah,
not
yeah, yeah.
Not wet weather, right?
It doesn't have...
It doesn't matter if it's sunny.
Yeah, exactly.
When you're putting on a book festival you've got big tents.
It was a couple of years ago that there was the big storm.
We lost a tent.
Yeah.
And I had to... This is a great Irish scene. I had to ring the priest in Dalkey.
To pray for the tent.
Not to pray for the tent. The tent at this stage had disappeared into Dalkey Sound. We couldn't put it up, right? There was a sort of a bizarre... I've decided I'm a great hater of the southern wind.
All right.
This is what I'll tell you about him and again. Right.
Because
he brings all sorts of horrible things that I didn't know much about. In fact, we're going to talk about Joyce later on.
Okay.
And the southern wind blowing up the Irish Sea. We'll talk about that. But I had to ring the priest in Dalkey and beg for the use of the hall, i.e. the big church, the Catholic church.
I remember this. I remember arriving in Dalkey walking straight into a crisis and me looking around going, what the hell's going on? We've lost a tent.
Not only did we lose a tent, it was a big tent. It was a 400-seater tent.
Yeah.
And
yeah, I remember.
Yeah, that was a while ago. And Father Declan, a lovely man, I rang. I said, Declan, how are you? He said, David, how are you doing? I said, I'm not great. He said, why? I said, it's 2 p.m. on a Friday afternoon and an uncharacteristic storm has descended on Dalkey.
Yeah,
the hand of God has taken our tent. Can I have the use of the hall? And he said, the big hall or the little hall? I said, the big bloody church. He said, fine.
It's fair play to him.
Yeah, and actually, it was great. He said, lovely fellow, Father Declan. Anyway, Dalkey Book Festival.
Yeah.
This weekend, watching the weather, 75 events. 100 speakers, 4 days, flying stuff. We might talk about it later on. But that's what is worrying me these days, John.
Yes.
This is on my mind.
Excessive
worry about the weather, weather fronts, gyres, and the whore that is the southern wind.
The whore that is the southern wind.
Yeah. It's a shocking thing. Well, what about you? After all that.
How can I follow that? Jeez. Well, I tell you what I've been doing this week. I haven't been watching the weather, but I've been America watching.
Well, you love a bit of America.
I've kind of missed it a little bit, but it's because the insurrection.
By the way, John misses Trump just for the entertainment value.
Actually, too. But he's back in the news this week because some of the reports coming out about the investigation into the insurrection on January 6th.
Yeah.
But you can see now, like, Trump is banjaxed. He's absolutely banjaxed. And it's so clear that he was orchestrated the whole thing.
He's
and
the cryptocurrency of politicians.
But the really interesting thing is that, which I didn't fully appreciate before, is that he's now turning on Ivanka, his favourite child.
Or Ivanka, as
Ivanka,
he says.
Yeah. He's turning on her because she sided with Bill Barr, who agreed that actually the election wasn't stolen. So it's imploding and it's just going in one way and it's one to watch, and I'll come back to you about that. But also I was...
It is. It's like the political equivalent of Ozark or something, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
I would say, who is the Ruth Longmore in the whole thing?
There'll be brilliant Netflix series all about this in the years to come.
Yeah, defo.
But the other thing I was looking at as well was listening to Janet Yellen and her doom and gloom forecast for inflation in America.
And it's go on.
But what she was saying is like inflation this week in America has hit a 40-year high. Remember we spoke before about this 40-year cycle that we're coming to the end. This certainly marks the end of this 40-year cycle.
Absolutely. Well, I've always thought that economics goes in these large cycles.
Mm.
And what I've always found really ridiculous is this idea of annual forecasts, right?
Yeah.
So, for example, as if there was an economic calendar which synced with the Roman calendar, right?
Yeah, so you'd say,
okay, in the first quarter in January, right? So basically the economic calendar has got nothing to do with the annual calendar. It's a much longer term, much more slow, much more evolving creature. And I always think it comes in these large, large sweeps. And one of those large sweeps is the fact that in the last 40 years, we have been in a period of disinflation, not deflation, but disinflation, where inflation has been very low.
Right. Okay. Yeah.
So, and the reasons for that are multitudinous. There are many, many reasons. One is original central bank policy in the 1980s of very high real interest rates. Probably much more consequential has been the opening of China and India, expanding the global labor force by over 2 billion. And also the very rapid acceleration in the tech industry. Tech is, by definition, technology is deflationary.
Yeah.
And the reason it is deflationary, typically technology takes out the middleman. So the idea, take, for example, something like an eBay. What eBay actually does is it takes away the retail sector.
Yeah.
And the retail sector is where there's markup.
Yeah.
Right? So basically you have a shop, you can mark up.
But eBay then is the middleman.
What they've done, eBay is the middleman, but it's taken out that retail and it's compressed prices.
Yeah.
So there has been this technological change. There has been this demographic change, which is China and India joining. And there has been a downward pressure on inflation from high real interest rates in the 1980s and to a degree the 1990s. So all of these things have come together at a time. Also, companies have been obsessed with this thing called shareholder value, which means that you actually squeeze costs all the time. And the majority of costs in any company are wages.
Yeah.
So you've had this, particularly in America, you've had this compression of wages. So American real wages for the average person haven't really risen since the 1980s.
I would argue the same is the case here.
Well, real wages have risen here quite dramatically in the last couple of years, but we're in a...
Not in every sector, but we're in a sort of different...
But let's look at the States, because we're... The States is...
Yeah.
So the States, so that was an ideology. Now, within all these ideologies, John, no matter how successful they are, and it has been successful in terms of the growth of the economy, is there's always the seeds of its own destruction.
Mm.
And the seeds of its own destruction were inequality, right? So basically, as people who owned all these assets got rich and people who worked for a living got relatively poorer, what you found was inequality expanded dramatically. And that has changed. So now what you're seeing is inflation is all about pricing power.
Mm.
Okay. It's not about global money supply or any sort of a lot of the things that the economists will talk to you about. So the monetarist idea is that if you print money, it will inflate. Well, that's proven to be spectacularly inaccurate since 2008.
Yeah.
So, I mean, the idea that you print money, the state prints money, and therefore you get immediate inflation has been profoundly wrong for 14 years.
Mm.
But now you're seeing inflation. But I think what you see is in pricing power. So labor in America is scarce. So they're saying we want higher wages.
Yeah.
And then, of course, you've got this Putin inflation coming for Putin.
Yeah.
All of this has happened at one time. My sense is people shouldn't panic. There's a huge panic going on now. Right, central bankers, Janet Yellen, they're all panicking. They're worried about the 1970s, et cetera, right?
But why not? I mean, it's not, the outlook doesn't look good, so why not panic?
Well, if you look at the pendulum swing away from profits and towards wages, wages will always materialize in higher levels of inflation.
Mm.
And my sense is that if you think that energy prices are the cause, well, then energy prices will fall back to earth as soon as there is a truce in Ukraine.
Yeah.
And as soon as there is a way of financing gas that isn't Russia.
Yeah.
And ultimately, as we've been talking about the transition to clean energy ultimately is cheap energy.
Yeah.
Renewables is cheap. So the outlook for global energy over a 10 or 15 year period has to be that energy gets cheaper, not more expensive.
Yeah.
So that's the first thing. The second thing is that if wages rise, I think that's quite a good thing. And if profits fall, I think that's not a bad thing either, because profits have been so high relative to wages.
Yeah, sure.
But what the Fed and Yellen seem to be profoundly worried about is the speed at which this adjustment happens.
Yeah.
So the way in which you should look at the difference between the government and the Fed is this brakes and accelerator, right? The Fed always wants to put the brakes on the economy. The government always wants to push down the accelerator, because a strong economy means you tend to get voted in,
yes,
right?
Yeah, yeah.
So it's this battle at the heart of America between the government and the Fed. And of course, the financial markets now tend to be the arbiter, like they're almost like the referee.
I wanted to ask you about that, because I was reading here as well, like on Friday last week, the S&P 500 was down by nearly 3%, which apparently is huge. So people are getting out of the stock market. And I'm kind of curious, if they're getting out of that, where the hell are they going?
Well, this is the interesting. So they're not buying bonds. So basically, remember we talked about this a couple of weeks ago, that usually if the stock market rises, the bond market falls and vice versa.
Yes,
right?
Yeah, yeah.
The problem now is people are worried about stagflation, which is this combination of lower growth and inflation together. That destroys earnings, but the higher inflation destroys the return to bonds. So you're getting bonds being sold off and stocks. And that's why there's a big kerfuffle in financial markets.
So where are they going? Where are they putting
money? So I think most
to?
People are... Now, I would say going to cash, because they don't know what's going to happen in the future. But
crypto?
Crypto's gone. No, I mean, literally, I mean, Bitcoin's down at $27.
Yeah.
So it was up at 60. You know, this is the slow death of a bullshit idea.
Right.
And when I say a bullshit idea, I mean something that is just, it's not money.
Yeah.
It's a speculative asset. And it's basically, if you buy crypto, or if you buy Bitcoin, what you are buying is you're buying into an enterprise with no income. And if you buy into an enterprise with no income, there is no return other than you expect the next guy to come through the door to pay you more for the token.
Yeah, yeah.
So,
and it was supposed to be this hedge against inflation.
This is a great example. Yeah. So one of the main economic thrusts of crypto / Bitcoin, I know they're different, and the crypto people get freaked out about the difference between them and say you don't understand the technology. Well, look, these are tokens, right? They might as well be cowrie shells. Right? They're tokens, right? Now,
or football cards.
Or football cards, right? Mm-hmm. NFTs, do you remember them? Nobody fucking talks about them anymore, right? So these are end of cycle craziness. But if you accept that there is a thing called fintech, in fact, I'm talking to John Collison this week, and fintech will change the world, but it doesn't necessarily mean that means the tokenization of finance. It doesn't mean, right?
Yeah.
So with respect to a lot of the cryptos, basically you were hoping that somebody came in who bought, which is what's called the greater fool theory.
Yeah, yeah.
The greater gobshite theory. There's a bigger gobshite down the road who'll pay more, right? So that is a part of the effervescence of any sort of asset that has no income.
Yeah.
And when an asset has no income at a time of extraordinary flux where everyone's reassessing their risk profile, the very fact it has no income means it's worth nothing.
Okay.
Its income is absolutely essential in times of uncertainty. In good times, where we're all pitching that tomorrow's going to be fantastic and next year, and don't worry about earnings, don't worry about profits, these old-fashioned things, right? Then you can discount income and you can say, well, you know what? This company's going to make a fortune in the future, so I'll buy it now. I'll hold on to it now. I'll do the ride from early investor to mature investor and I'll make money. But once interest rates start to rise, once there's a sense of jeopardy, what everybody wants is income.
Right? But the likes of gold doesn't have any income though either.
But gold has got use, called jewelry use. So people buy gold. So half of India
buys
gold to wear it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah,
so gold has always had this unusual, I haven't seen people wear Bitcoin yet. Okay. Right? Maybe it is going to happen. But so gold is this bizarre thing that it has a use, an adornment use.
Yeah.
And it has this hoarding. But what gives gold its value is the adornment use.
Right.
Is the fact that it's always used as jewelry, adornment. Lizzie Windsor had a gold carriage the other day.
She did indeed.
Do you know what I mean, right?
Yeah, she wasn't even in it though. It was a hologram of her.
Exactly. So that's the difference. In fact, if people are interested in gold, a great book by Peter Bernstein called The History of Gold. And it's an amazing book.
Right.
Full of crazy detail, like the speed of camels in the Sahara Desert.
The
camel transformed economics in the Sahara Desert. Right. So gold was made in Guinea. Remember we talked about this last week?
Yeah.
And it was brought up, was exchanged for salt.
Yeah.
But up until the emergence of the camel as a transport technology, it was very, very difficult to transport anything.
Yeah, especially gold because it's so heavy.
Yeah, there's great detail. I love all this. There's great detail in the book of the impact of the speed of the camel over many hundreds of years on trade.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it is good.
So, that would affect directly the velocity of money.
Money, exactly.
Yeah.
The velocity of the camel, right? So the camel emerges.
Exactly.
The camel emerges. I mean, always been used by the Egyptians years and years ago.
Yeah, yeah.
But becomes honed by the Arabs.
Yeah.
Who actually, and of course, you know, in the same ways people breed stallions now, in the old days, they bred camels for speed.
Yeah.
But the speed was the ability of the camel to walk. And then, of course, you got the whole idea of the oasis and the difference between...
Amazing.
It's a fascinating story.
Yeah, yeah, that's
so
great.
So we digress.
Yes,
but the history of gold, again. But let's come back to right now. My sense, now maybe I'm being far too sanguine, is that we shouldn't panic in the face of rising inflation, not least because the foundational element of the inflation is the energy price.
Yeah.
Right? And that's feeding into food prices. But it's absolutely the case that inflation is going to have a profound effect on poor countries, because poor countries spend a higher proportion of their income on food than rich countries.
Yeah.
And if there is a food crisis in Africa or in North Africa, particularly North Africa is highly dependent on wheat exports from Russia
and
from Ukraine, the migratory impact of this is going to be phenomenal for Europe. If you're sitting in any Maghreb country and you're on a smartphone made in China and you see...
Maghreb?
Maghreb is... So Maghreb is all the Arab region, North African. That's what they call them.
Oh,
so
I've
Morocco,
never heard that
Libya,
phrase
Algeria, Tunisia, Egypt, all these countries, right?
Maghreb, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. There's actually a great little wine bar called La Cave just off Grafton Street.
I know.
Down
well,
the hole, right? And we used to go there years ago to drink very late at night.
Yeah.
Very fine place, by the way. Run by people, I think, from Morocco.
Right.
And a poxy wine, but we still could afford years ago, used to come with a label. The label was made in the Maghreb.
So meant
the wine was so unspecific that it was made either in one of these countries
it's
or
a cheeky
all
little
these
number.
It's a cheeky little florid number. Okay, but Le Cave, shout out to Le Cave, great little spot. Anyway, where are we? Inflation.
Yes.
Okay, So I think what's going to happen is if the Americans are really serious about bringing down inflation really quickly, they will have to put real interest rates into very positive territory. At the moment, inflation is 8% in America.
Yeah.
The bond yields are 3%.
Yeah.
That means real interest rates are minus 5%. So this is extraordinary loose monetary policy.
So what do they need to do?
If they're really serious about it, they have to go to at least 8% nominal interest rates, or 10. So you'd have to have a positive real interest rate to bear right down on inflation. And that basically means destroying the economy.
So there's no way they're going to do that.
Now, this is where Jay Powell and Joe Biden could be absolutely at loggerheads. Because the last time that happened, Paul Volcker and Reagan, right? But Paul Volcker was doing Reagan's dirty work. Because Reagan's dirty work was to destroy the trade union movement.
Yeah.
Destroy the labor movement.
Yeah.
Right? So positive real interest rates for Reagan were a sufficiently high price to pay to destroy American blue collar.
Right. Okay.
Trade unions. Because the American blue collar was essentially the Democratic Party.
Yeah.
Teamsters, Hoffa and all that sort of stuff. Yeah, right? Yeah. Okay. Now, Jay Powell and Joe Biden are not on the same side. So Joe Biden's not all Scranton, Pennsylvania, blue-collar workers, right?
Yeah.
Jay Powell is a private equity guy.
Yeah, yeah,
they are
yeah.
totally different creatures, right?
From the Hamptons or somewhere,
yeah,
isn't he?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. He's really posh. He's from Washington, but like his parents are really posh and all that sort of thing. So they're a totally different sides, whereas Paul Volcker and Reagan were on the same side. But interesting, just to get back to the States, I've heard from people I know in Silicon Valley that the credit crunch is there.
Right.
That you cannot get capital. So Silicon Valley has gone from getting any owl gobshite with any owl idea could get tens of millions of quid. There's no capital there now.
Right.
Right.
Okay.
So it's changed overnight. Big issue in Dublin. Loads and loads of the tech companies are laying people off for the first time in 10 years. Right. So there's been a total collapse in the optimism of tech.
Yeah.
Right? The optimism, the effervescence, the idea that the world is changing. And of course, many of those companies use their share price as their balance sheet, in effect. Mm. So their share price was rising. So they felt we can do this because we have this balance sheet, right? So they were using their share price as currency, either to buy other companies or to pay workers. So if you're in a Google sort of situation or whatever it's called now.
Alphabet,
right, okay. Yeah. Spaghetti Alphabet. Do you remember Alphabet Spaghetti?
I do. I used to love it.
So did I. Where's the W? The Williams. Where's the W? There's no W here, ma'am. Actually, on that, I'm going to really digress. Andrea Catherwood's mother, you know Andrea, our friend,
who's
going to come to the Dorky Book Festival. She used to present Romper Room. Do you remember Romper Room in BBC? No, in Ulster Television.
Right. Yeah,
she used to look through. She used to look through a tennis racket, say, I can see, and the children be waiting. See, and I always remember, I spoke to Adrian before, she goes, I can see Trevor and Victor and Ivan. There was no Shamey or Porrick or Eamon. All the Fenians were never seen in the north. But anyway, we digress. Back to the issue that what I'm saying is that the increase in interest is already having an impact on the frothier end.
Yeah.
And that is technology. And we'll see that impacting here because what's keeping rents up are all the high-paid tech workers in town.
Yeah.
So let's see what happens.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And UnitedHealthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
And there's Bloom with his knock-me-down cigar, saying, eucatetical.
How are you, Bosco? Yes, did you see?
I did see, Mike, on the front page of Saturday's FT and the weekend section, Life and Arts, Markers, full page spread on his essay on
Bloomonomics.
Bloomonomics. And a fair play to you. That's brilliant. It's a fantastic essay.
Well, it's an essay that is actually something I've been thinking about. You know, I've been thinking about this for quite a while.
Yeah.
And it's an essay that explains, and it really comes to something that I've always maintained, that artists and entrepreneurs are of very similar mindset.
Mm.
And it stems from the fact that when I was reading Ulysses this year, remember I said I was going to read the whole thing, right?
Yeah.
And I did a lot of research.
Did you?
And I read the hard bits, I got an audiobook. A fella called Jim Norton, a great actor, has got a fantastic audiobook. So when you really get bogged down, yeah. I went to Jim's audiobook and I listened to it and read at the same time.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah.
But it's really, really very good. You know, I mean, there's very few novels that end with a woman coming.
Right. I haven't read that. So you've just ruined the end for me.
Well, I mean, that's the most...
Spoiler alert.
That's a spoiler alert, but it is pretty impressive ending have been written, you know, 100 years ago.
Yeah.
You know, a woman orgasm is the actual end of the whole thing. So that's pretty impressive.
It's fantastic.
Okay, so anyway, the whole thing is fantastic. But reading it, and then I read a fellow called Richard Ellman's Joyce, which is the kind of definitive biography. There's also another great one, a guy called John McBride, an Irish guy, who writes about Joyce and Trieste, those years, which are very formative. And then Declan Kybert, who's a professor of Anglo-Irish literature, asked me to contribute an article to a new book, which is out on Thursday, called The Book About Everything, 18 Artists, Writers and Thinkers on Joyce's Ulysses. And I wrote about...
18, not 17.
18, that's very funny. Actually, John's referring to it. It's quite funny. There's a review. I've always found that lots of Irish academia is very sniffy. And there's a review of this book in the Irish Times this week, of which I write for. And it goes through, there's 18 people have contributed, and it goes, it's hilarious. Names 17 of them, not me.
You're left on the bench.
I'll talk to you about Irish. Some of the nether regions of Irish academia and the sneakiness. But that's quite funny. I mean, it's so blatant. I've been ghosted by an academic. Yeah. You know the podcast, my agent ghosted me, my therapist ghosted me. And obviously my reviewer ghosted me. Anyway, but the kernel of the issue is when Joyce had finished writing Dubliners and he was trying to get Dubliners published for a long, long time. And he was beginning to despair. And he was living in Trieste. And his sister, in 1909, said to him, while she was in Trieste, do you know, and cinemas were the big thing. We've talked about this before. Cinemas were the big, big thing. Do you know there's no cinemas in Dublin? And Joyce said, okay, I'm going to open the first cinema, right?
Right.
And there's a lovely, lovely image of him. Remember we talked about the South Wind, the whore that is the South Wind.
Yes.
Okay, so the South Wind, imagine, you know, between Ireland and Britain, we never think of it. It's basically just like a funnel. Water's funneled in from the Atlantic.
Yeah.
And when the South Wind blows, it gets incredibly choppy because the South Wind is blowing all this water, pushing all this water up through the Atlantic and then into this tiny little funnel between Ireland and Britain. So it means that the sea gets incredibly choppy. And of course, in the end of October, I think it was the 23rd of October, 1909, there is a tall 27-year-old lanky individual in a pair of tennis shoes puking violently over the side of the mailboat.
And I have been that man, you know, on many occasions.
On the way back from England.
Yes, yes.
That's because you're full of red stripe. And he comes home to set up the cinema.
Yeah.
And I was intrigued by this. I thought, this interests me. And I've always thought the type of mind
that sets up a cinema and the type of mind that writes something like Ulysses are very, very similar.
Mm.
Because setting up a company is an act of defiance. In a way, you're waving your fingers at everybody, say, I'm going to go out on my own.
Mm.
I have something to say. I have something to do. Writing a book is an act of defiance. It basically is, I'm going to do something better. And the mindset of the entrepreneur and the artist are very similar. They live in the world of risk. They're always in jeopardy. Nothing's ever secure. Today's success doesn't necessarily mean tomorrow is going to be a success. In fact, often success in the arts and in the commercial entrepreneurial world is just simply the prelude for failure the next time, right?
Yeah.
They have to express themselves commercially. They have to express themselves. It's in their DNA. They're regularly kind of awkward people, not particularly, sometimes they're hard to get on with, but at their sense, they are dissenters. Entrepreneurs and artists dissent from the normal run-of-the-mill world.
Yeah.
And this intrigued me. And then when I started to read Bloom, sort of read about Bloom, started to read about the character Leopold Bloom, who was fascinated with everything, was a dissenter, was also the classic outsider. I mean, the great thing was he was a Jew by his father's name, but he was actually baptized three times, once Protestant, once Catholic, and once for the crack. Okay? So he was a complete outsider. Okay?
But also what I thought was the most peculiar thing about him was that he was an ad man.
He was an ad man. And by being an ad man, this is the absolutely, you're right. By Joyce deciding that Bloom was an ad man, he put Bloom into the commercial world.
Yeah.
Right? He put Bloom into the world of dreams, into the world of value, into that extraordinary, unspecific world where the ad man lives, which is inside the head of the customer.
Yeah.
That's where the ad man gets his or hers. They tell stories to people. And then you watch Bloom and you watch the sort of interests he had and the sort of way he looked at the world. And then at the end, there's an extraordinary scene, the third last chapter, right? Is Bloom with Stephen Dedalus, the young artist.
Yeah.
And they're in the cabman's shelter under Butt Bridge.
Right.
Stephen is locked. He's sobering up. He's been down the whorehouses. Brothel, right? As too has Bloom, but he had a very bizarre dream in Bella Cohn's brothel. It's really great stuff. Mad, right?
Yes. Yeah.
But Bloom gets Stephen and he's trying to say to Stephen, look, you're an artist. It's time to sober up. You need this almost, you're a bohemian, but you need this bourgeois discipline of hard work to actually go and write.
Yeah.
And he's saying that Dublin is, all the whorehouses and the bars, they're just faux bohemia and they'll drag you down. And now you need to get your shit together and write.
Yeah.
And finish your work and get away from this idea that you're the artist waiting for something to happen. You've got to make it happen.
Yeah.
You've got to be this entrepreneur. You've got to execute yourself. And it,
sound advice.
It is really sound. Well, basically you've got the young Stephen and the older Bloom.
Yeah.
You have the young bohemian and the older bourgeois character. But again, Bloom wanted to be bourgeois, but he liked the nighttime, the seediness.
Yeah.
And of course, he wanted this have his proper marriage, but he couldn't achieve it because at the moment, his wife is sleeping with Blazes Boylan. That's the whole point of him being knocking around, okay? Joyce was very similar. Like he wanted to have the family life, but he couldn't get it, right?
Yeah.
He couldn't achieve it. So there's fascinating things, but I come back to this basic idea that the society, and this comes back to the way in which we run societies, dynamic economies are also dynamic artistic places. They're dynamic social places that dissenters make the world go round. These creative individuals who won't take orders, who don't want a job, who don't want a boss, they want to do their own thing. And societies that actually embrace those outsiders and what I would say confer dignity onto their efforts tend also to be the societies that are unbelievably economically dynamic. And why is this? Is because expressing yourself morally or sexually or whatever you want to do, right, and commercially are two sides of the same coin.
Yeah, the yin and the yang.
Yeah, and they're about freedom and they're about an ability to say, I want to do something different.
Mm.
And in order to dissent from that, you need a society that's non-dogmatic. And I think this is what Joyce was doing by making his hero a Jewish outsider in a Christian city.
Right.
By making it all right, he's basically saying, I'm for the outsider. And he's also saying that I'm for the entrepreneur, the commercial whiz, as well as the artistic. And I think this is a message in the book. There are many thousands of messages, but this is a message in the book. And this is the thesis of the Financial Times article from this weekend. And just finally, John, on Dublin, if you look at the city that your mother was born in, your mother was born in the inner city, right?
Yes, she was.
If you look at the city that Bloom occupies, the city that Joyce created, right? It is an extraordinarily vibrant place with everybody living there, young and old, rich and poor, cultures and dubs, unionists and nationalists.
Yeah, yeah.
Jews, all sorts of people hanging out. And it's a vibrant living organism. And if you look at Dublin City right now, if you go into Dublin City right now, what you have is the soul is gone.
Yeah.
There's nobody living there. Only the hyper-rich corporate elite can afford to live there, or the urban poor that have always lived there. There's nothing in the middle. Whereas Joyce's Ulysses and Bloom was all about the middle ground, hanging out with the poor, hanging out with the rich, doing their thing. And it is amazing. But
that was a policy that was pursued way back when they moved all the people from kind of Summerhill and Gardiner Street and just replanted them in Talla.
Crumlin initially, and then Talla later on. But nobody replaced them. Like, it's not.
No, but that's right, because my mother is talking. My mother's 90 next month. And these days she's harking back to her youth. And how
Harcourt Street, wasn't she?
She was both Harcourt Street and Camden Street.
Yeah.
And she always talked about the buzz. She also talked a lot about the absolute poverty in the tenements and stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Which wasn't particularly nice. But it was, as you say, it was a buzzing city. There was life in it at all hours of the day and night.
Yeah. I mean, cities have to be alive. Mm. That's the message. And what is kind of interesting, this Thursday, you'll have all these Bloomsday things going on. And Irish tourism or Dublin tourism is essentially selling an image of the city that is suggestive that the city is alive with people living over the shop.
Yeah.
With people. And you look at Dublin, it's derelict. Nobody lives in the centre of the city. Huge amount of places that could be lived in are left to go idle. There are sites all around the place which nobody's living on. There's no even buildings on them.
Yeah.
Lots and lots of buildings going to disrepair. And the city that Joyce loved and the city that we see now are two profoundly different things. There's one thing that Joyce did love. He loved Dublin. And maybe it's about time that we also started loving Dublin.
Now, just before we go, we're going to end with a little treat. Proud dad Mac is sitting over there grinning, and so he ought to, because this is Lucy McWilliams, the girl with the golden voice, her latest track called Medication.
I'm so sick of medication. I can't take it anymore. I've been swallowed by my bed. I think I'm dead and I can't get out. I always make up situations that people tell me to ignore. Everything that I regret is in my head and it screams so loud. Why does it feel like I've been waiting for a call? Maybe I'm stuck in the same trap after all. I've been running around in circles and climbing up the walls, but I think there's only one way out. After life. Anything to stop this fall. I've been drinking all my hope to help me cope. Now the drugs don't work. wish this devil wasn't in me. I wish I had a second chance. And we pretend the coast is, but I can't live with it haunting me. Why does it feel like I've been waiting for a call? Maybe I'm stuck in the same trap after all. I've been running around in circles and climbing up the walls, and I think there's only one way out. After life, 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 after
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.